This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com. Welcome to Dishy Mix. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. Thanks for tuning into the show today. I have a great guest on the show, Bob Garfield. Most of you know Bob as the ad critic on Ad Age. Bob is ad critic at Ad Age. He's a blogger in what he calls the Bobosphere. He's a personality on NPR. He's the author of two books and some experimental, what I'll call essays, and we'll talk about some more. He's an international speaker. He's a political advertising analyst, which is a fabulous place to be an analyst, and a fearless journalist. We're going to talk to Bob, and some of the things we're going to talk about today include poker, 2,000 flushes, king rat, everyman, contemplating suicide, the biggest liars and bigoted buffoons, monkey vision, brand hickeys, Don Quixote, and of course, Bill Gates. So stay tuned.
Somewhere in the Ten Commandments, there's one that, you know, that's sort of gone missing that says, "Thou shalt have free entertainment subsidized by ads and live with ads for the rest of your life."
You have called people bigoted buffoons. You have self-described as a media whore. You've talked about people being evangelical cyber geeks. You've mentioned a category of humanity as godless tax and spend baby-killing Osama-loving Democrats. There's, of course, the peppered terminology of scumbags. I know, it was ironic. Scumbags, racists, liars, fearmongers. You've even discussed drawer soiling.
So, you know, the ones that I say are not going to make it quickly disappear. Sometimes, of course, they immediately disappear, like I write on a Monday and they disappear on a Tuesday. That happens every now and then.
You are a political advertising and analyst.
Yeah, well,
what a green field. I mean, like, that's like taking candy from a baby, isn't it?
Well, as a matter of fact, it is. It's kind of like that with consumer-generated video. You know, you put a lot of monkeys at a lot of computers with a lot of digital cameras, and eventually they'll come up with something worth watching. But it's going to take a lot of monkeys a long time.
Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm glad to have you, and thank you. You said you're doing me a favor by being on the show. I know you don't do a lot of podcasts, so for those of you listening today, you're very lucky to have Mr. Garfield with us today. Mostly, it's just hard to pin him down because he's always on the road traveling, speaking at some location or other. So, Bob, one of the first things I want to talk about is your speaking platform right now. What are the things that you're talking about? Is it Listenomics, chaos theory, or are you working on something new?
No, it's pretty much Listenomics and the chaos theory. It's all about what happens when the old structures of media and marketing collapse before our very eyes, and the brave new world is not quite prepared to replace the cowardly old one. And the consequence is media content producers who don't know where their next dollar is going to come from, and marketers not knowing how to reach consumers. So it's pretty chaotic, and I present a pretty bleak picture, but I think there are also solutions down the line somewhere.
I'm going to read from a recent article in Ad Age that you wrote. I'm going to quote it directly. "Digital tools and database marketing will open channels of communication and reservoirs of information that will relegate display advertising as we've known it to a subsidiary role. Most likely, it will serve as a series of signposts, logos, and simple messages pointing users to websites where the real action is." Now, that makes total sense to me. The question I have is this still a surprise to people who are doing marketing and advertising?
Oh, my God. It's a surprise. It's it's anathema. I mean, their lives, their livelihoods, their worldviews are all built up around a media marketing symbiotic relationship in which, you know, people tune to major distributors of content for free programming, and it's all subsidized by advertising, and everybody lives happily ever after. But, you know, and the assumption is that, you know, somewhere in the Ten Commandments, there's one that, you know, that's sort of gone missing that says, thou shalt have free entertainment subsidized by ads and live with ads for the rest of your life. But, you know, there is no such commandment, and I think what we are facing, you know, and I say this as someone who writes for Advertising Age, for a post-advertising age in which advertising exists but simply is just not as central to the economy and the culture as it has been for all of our lives. That's a tough one to swallow if that's how, you know, you make your living.
So what is it? People who have a TV budget, a print budget, a billboard budget, whatever it is, they don't know how to live by the new rules, so they have to hold on to what they have?
Yeah, one of the few things that's keeping the old media afloat anymore is that marketers, you know, literally are bereft of other options. They, you know, they're putting a little money online, and they're putting a little money in, you know, outdoor and experiential and so forth, but basically they're still on TV because it's the only place they can, you know, really reach any kind of mass numbers, and they're paying increasing premiums to do so, to reach decreasing numbers of viewers and readers. And, you know, this won't go on forever. The law of diminishing returns will eventually kick in. And, you know, they may pay more and more for less and less, but they're not going to pay infinitely for nothing. So, and the only reason they're hanging on is because there's just no other place to reach people. But, you know, but again, we will eventually reach a tipping point where it simply makes no economic sense. You know, at the same, and as advertisers flee revenues to the original, to the traditional mainstream distributors of entertainment and news, or they're going to have fewer resources to produce, and so quality quality is already dropping precipitously, and which will create even more fleeing viewers, which will create even more fleeing advertisers, and so on, and an, you know, endless vortex of ruin. So it behooves everybody to find another solution for A, entertaining the masses, and B, reaching the consumer. And it's out there. There's no question but what it's out there. There's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built to make it all really come to fruition.
You just said the term endless vortex of destruction. Now, I'm not hearing a lot of phrases like that in everyday conversation, but in your everyday conversation, apparently, these are pretty common words. I'm going to quote some of the phraseology from some of the work that you've done. You've used terms such as...
This is not fair.
Oh, it's fair.
Okay, so let's just say the last few years I haven't exactly been a laugh riot, okay?
Yeah, you dish it out, man, and now you're going to get it back. Are you ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
You have called people bigoted buffoons. You have self-described as a media whore. You've talked about people being evangelical cyber geeks. You've mentioned a category of humanity as godless tax and spend baby-killing Osama-loving Democrats. There's, of course, the peppered terminology of scumbags.
That one was ironic. Okay?
I know, it was ironic. Scumbags, racists, liars, fear-mongers. You've even discussed drawer soiling. Explain yourself.
Truthfully, I don't remember the drawer soiling line.
Oh, it's there.
But, you know, I don't doubt that I wrote it. It's pretty Bob-like. Well, you know, they pay me to tell people what I think, and I've got this candor problem.
You're like a crusty SOB, I think, aren't you? You're not really, but you write like a crusty SOB. I have a feeling you're like a squishy little teddy bear. But
I am a total teddy bear. But the thing is, it makes it ever so much sweeter for everybody when I'm nice, which I am, by the way, more than half the time. So aren't laurels much more delicious when they come from somebody who is equally prepared to cut you off at the knees? I think so.
I think they are. Absolutely. The positivism from a fear perspective. So that's a perfect segue for me into the fact that for a living, you review advertising. How can this ever be nothing personal? You say it's nothing personal when you do it, but gosh, how do you keep it that way? Can you really?
Well, the main trick is not to ever know anybody whose work I'm reviewing. I really go to extreme lengths to cloister myself with the industry. You know, I live in Washington, D.C., where there is no advertising industry. When I come to New York to work on my show, I virtually never encounter anyone from the business that I criticize. The only time I ever see anyone from the business or talk to them, apart from the PR people who help me, you know, get material, is in Cannes, which I don't even go to every year. So I've worked pretty hard not to have relationships, and therefore, you know, people may put me, write me off as a fool or as a jerk or as a know-nothing, but they cannot accurately say that I'm taking care of friends or going after enemies, because I don't have any friends or enemies to help or harm. It's pretty important. And the other thing is, of course, I'm not in the business. I've never been in the business. So, some people say that I therefore have no credibility, but my argument is that I actually have far more credibility because I'm not influenced by relationships, current, previous, or future, and can say what I think, which I think, as you have correctly observed, I often do.
We love that about you, in truth. Now, you keep yourself clean and pure as the driven snow, which is good. How'd you get the chops to be an ad critic? What makes you think you could be an ad critic, Bob Garfield?
Well, that's a pretty good question, too. it doesn't take much. Well, first, I'm not stupid, okay?
No, you aren't. You're a smart man.
Secondly, I've steeped myself for more than 25 years in the industry. I mean, I have thought very deeply about thousands and thousands of ads. And by the way, I think I can prove by marketplace results that I haven't often been wrong about these things. But
how do you measure it?
You can tell whether a campaign is succeeding by how long it exists.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, the campaigns that I've said are going to do well.
Yeah, but maybe they're just running them longer because you said they're good.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. And others, the ones that I say are not going to make it quickly disappear. Sometimes, of course, they immediately disappear, like I write on a Monday and they disappear on a Tuesday. That happens every now and then. If you're not, it's not that complicated a business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, the business of the business has many complications. But fundamentally, it's about selling goods and services to consumers and communicating and not lying and being ethical and understanding your audience. There's a fairly small checklist of things to do and not do that, for someone who's a non-moron, it's really not all that difficult to, divine the difference between good and bad. And then, you have also have to be able to write entertainingly, which I can. So you put those together, and you're thoughtful, and, you're intellectually honest, and it's really not a hard job. In fact, it's an easy job. The only hard part is dealing with the consequences of when something you write, causes people problems in their businesses or their lives. That's not.
Do you feel bad about that sometimes when you have to just shred the crap out of a campaign? What goes through? Pangs of guilt or sadness? Or how do you feel when you write that?
I'll just tell you honestly. When I've written cleverly, I feel, I like that. It makes, and if I think I've done an astute analysis that goes beyond, something very superficial, I'm pleased with myself about that. But when I'm dishing out 4 stars when I'm dishing out 0 stars, I never feel bad, because 0 stars only come from what I think are egregious assaults against, ethics or morality, honesty, and so forth. I think that people who are turning out what I call 0-star advertising deserved to be publicly upbraided, and whatever consequences befall them, so be it. But it's when I'm giving 2 stars, which is mediocrity and 1.5 stars and even 1 star for just, you know, kind of lame-ass advertising.
Mm-hmm.
I know, even though I'm not naming names, obviously the people who worked very hard on these campaigns.
Yeah.
You know, I may not take it personally, but they certainly are.
They're going to be in trouble.
And they're going to be, you know, they're going to be at a minimum embarrassed in front of their colleagues and their clients, and sometimes worse.
Yeah.
And of course I don't like that.
You think anybody's ever lost their job over a bad, over a, you know, 2 or 0 star review?
Yeah.
You think so? Yeah, that's a shame. Well, let's go back to those godless tax and spend baby-killing Osama-loving Democrats, because I just love saying that. You are a political advertising and analyst.
Yeah.
What a green field. I mean, like, that's like taking candy from a baby, isn't it?
Well, as a matter of fact, it is. Because I think political advertising is, or at least until the current administration took office, the deepest stain on our democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, really.
In a very, you know, bipartisan way.
Yeah.
Republican and Democratic alike, the politicians have lied, misrepresented their opponents, behaved as cynically as possible, not only to mislead voters, but I think in some cases actually to repel voters and to you know, I think the political consulting industry, that is a cesspool, and I think they have among them kind of conspired to turn people away from the political process and from civic life and from politics and from ideas, to mobilize people with lies and bumper sticker kind of ideology. And to frighten everybody else away.
I would like to see you blog much more. I'd like to see you vid blog or whatever it's going to be called much more often about the political campaigns. You know, you're throwing me a bone now and then. I want it all day, every day. I want to see once a week. I want an email from you with your analysis of the most egregious political battle over through advertising there is. I'd love that from you.
Well, you know, in the past I've done that. You know, I've been pretty diligent in past races about covering the greatest excesses, especially from the most significant candidates. But there's two reasons I've backed off from that. One is that, you know, there's hardly anything new to say. And number two is that the territory is pretty well covered now. I mean, because of the internet,
mm-hmm.
you can't really float an ad without it being subject to all of the scrutiny that I gave it in the pages of Ad Age for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's dozens, hundreds, sometimes thousands of people doing approximately the same thing. And now most of them are motivated by political ideology.
Yeah, they're not Bob Garfield.
Well,
and remember,
really,
just because
who among us is?
It's so true, Bob. It's the Bobosphere. If you're in the Bobosphere, you're in the special place.
So, and finally, Susan, you know, I'm just so dispirited. I'm so dispirited. But I've, you know, as you may know, for the last 7 years, I've also been co-host of a program called On the Media.
Yes, NPR, out of New York. Bob, political advertising. I can understand why you think everybody that you've already covered everything and everybody's already read it, but everybody hasn't read it. So even though you've maybe had enough, I'd encourage you to rethink that. And we're going to take a break right now. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about who you think the biggest liars are in the ad biz, because you track them. So stay tuned. We're with Bob Garfield, ad critic of Ad Age, NPR personality, author, international speaker, and great guy. And we'll be right back to find out about the big fat liars. Stay tuned.
Listen to Living Green, Effortless Ecology for Everyday People, a weekly online audio program featuring champions of sustainable living at personallifemedia.com.
We'll be right back. We're back, and I'm with Bob Garfield, ad critic, and we left off talking about political advertising, and I've posited to Bob about his opinion around, are the political advertisers the biggest liars, or is there someone even worse?
Is that my question?
That's your question, babe.
Allow me to address.
Yes, remember how it works here. Like, I ask the questions, and then you answer them.
I see.
You forgot.
It's like a reciprocity deal.
Yeah.
Okay,
we're dialoguing.
I can accommodate you.
Okay.
No, there is nobody worse than political advertisers because they lie or distort most of the time. And because of self-regulation, federal courts, and the FTC, most consumer advertisers tell the truth the vast majority of the time. Now, they put their best foot forward, and sometimes they veer from, into a very sketchy realm of half-truth. But, you know, by and large, the claims they make are defensible. I mean, I can talk to you for hours or days about, how badly they do at actually making claims as opposed to just, wanton entertainment, but that's another question. There are, however, several categories of advertising that I think are, pretty much embarrassments. Chronically. And, one is retail newspaper advertising, either for department stores or for consumer finance. A good rule of thumb is anytime there is more than an inch of fine print at the bottom of the ad, you know that everything in the headlines and the copy is basically untrue. This is very true of lease payments for automobiles, for consumer credit, and for department store and furniture store sales. But what troubles me the most is another category, and that is over-the-counter drugs.
Right.
In the same way that I believe that political consultants have either tacitly or explicitly conspired to put people off of the political process, I believe that pharmaceutical companies selling over-the-counter drugs have deliberately confused consumers about the ingredients of the OTC drugs that they're trying to sell to create the illusion that, their brand of cough and cold medicine or of analgesic or something is somehow different, has a point of differentiation between others. And, of course, they don't. They are all made of the same commodity chemicals in various combinations, and depending on what symptoms you want to deal with, but they try to suggest that their brand is somehow special, and it isn't. And as a consequence, I think there are millions and millions and millions of consumers who are mismedicating themselves, occasionally over-medicating themselves, occasionally under-medicating themselves. Because they simply don't know the basics of what it is they're buying, and that's a disgrace. Because after all, these are drugs that you're putting into your system, and sometimes into your children's system, and you don't have the vaguest idea, because of this quiet conspiracy, what it is you're buying. And I think it boggles the mind to imagine that the Food and Drug Administration and the FTC have not stepped in to demand clear labeling of ingredients on the front, and exactly the kind of effect they have on the body. You should not go into the supermarket or pharmacy and have to sit there and wonder exactly what the difference is between non-drowsy, aspirin-free. You name it.
Yep,
it should be clearly marked on the label.
So I have a new job for you.
Okay.
I'm going to appoint... Mickey Rooney's dead, so you're my choice. I would like to appoint you the MDA, the Marketing District Attorney, where justice prevails and there is no more marketing victimization. Would you take the job?
Well, tell me about the dental benefits.
How much does it pay? How much does it pay? $1 million, of course.
I mean, if it's just some stupid dental maintenance organization, no, forget it. I'll need the full package. And we really have to talk vacation and non-compete. But once we get that ironed out, you know, we can talk. Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good gig.
You're the Elliot Spitzer of the marketing world. I think it would be great to have to have that. And you know what? You really do that.
You know, and we should have that. And you know what that thing should be called? It should be called the government.
Oh, God, are you sure? I'm a little bit of a libertarian, sweetie. I'm not sure I need more government.
I'm very sure. You know, I believe in police on the beat. Because you know why? Because police on the beat reduce crime. But since approximately the early 80s, there have been no police on the beat. The regulatory agencies have been gutted. And in fact, they've been run by deregulators for, you know, the better part of the last 25 years. They're actually, you know, the fox has been guarding the hen house so long, it's hard to know what the hen house even does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that FTC and the FDA should aggressively regulate the marketing of consumer products, especially ones that are ingested. But they have been asleep at the switch since the Reagan administration, and, you know, I can't even foresee, you know, even in, a Hillary Clinton regime, them really coming back to any great degree, and I think it's a crime. I mean, regulation has, you know, I don't know if the government should be doing everything in our lives, but at a minimum, they should be protecting us from the excesses of marketers. Because, you know, one of the things about the free market is one of the things it's free of is conscience, and since it is free of conscience, the government has to step in and make sure that people are behaving right. And unfortunately, I think the government has vastly stepped away from that role, and consumers suffer.
I want to ask you, I'm going to turn the tables on you here, and I have a lot more questions to get to, and so you need to spend less time on your soapbox on each one. Are you ready?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Lightning round.
This is the lightning round. The first one is, the turn the tables question is something you ask someone that I thought was brilliant, so I'm going to ask you. Here we go. Okay, Don Quixote, what are your three windmills?
Whoa. Honesty in the political process. the Phillies reaching the playoffs. I really want to. I've only got two.
We'll take two. I like the Phillies in the playoffs. That's a good one. All right. So you called, Kevin Roberts from Saatchi & Saatchi wrote a book called Love Marks. You called it brand hickeys. Were you just being clever, or do you think the Love Marks concept is a little zany?
Listen, I got to tell you, I haven't read Kevin's book. I've only read about Kevin's book. So I'm not in a whole lot of position to comment.
All right. Well, it never stops you, does it?
Let's just say I'm extremely skeptical, particularly in the current age, about rebranding the whole idea of emotional connections in advertising as something special and calling it an innovation. That said, I think the Penny's campaign that they broke with that concept was really magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
But I continue to be skeptical whether, A, he's found anything new, and, B, whether emotional connections are going to be the future of marketing. I rather think it's the opposite, that it's going to be rational connections that are done not via advertising. So we shall see.
Interesting. God. Oh, I'm so torn. I want to know more about the rational connections not... I had another question, but tell me what you mean by the rational connections not created by advertising.
Well, I think people are interested in information. People, you know, care deeply about goods and services, I'm sorry to say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't quite understand what in human behavior makes us really want to know more and more about Tide, but people go by the, you know, millions to the P&G website to learn more about their detergent.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that has been true about all advertising all over the world for the last 30 years is that it's gotten less and less, it's less and less a purveyor of information and more, you know, a comedy blackout or a production spectacle that attempts to impress you without telling you anything and leaving the audience actually craving information. And the internet is perfectly situated for for giving consumers just that.
And that ties into Listenomics beautifully. So I completely understand your explanation. Let's move on. Consumer-generated video. You called it monkey vision. Why?
Oh, because, you know, they say that if you put a million monkeys at a million typewriters, eventually in time they will reproduce all of the works of Shakespeare. It's kind of like that with consumer-generated video. You know, you put a lot of monkeys at a lot of computers with a lot of digital cameras, and eventually they'll come up with something worth watching. But it's going to take a lot of monkeys a long time. but I'll tell you, the gems are certainly gems.
Yeah, the video that you recently had on the Bobosphere blog was I don't know who it is. Some guy who works for Microsoft in Brussels created a video of an advertiser, which was the guy, and the consumer, which was the woman, and it was the most fabulous clip about they were dating and he just didn't get her. And it was done from the perspective of the marketer in the agency. That was a beautiful clip to surface.
Yeah, I'm writing an entire book on a subject that they completely exhausted and perfectly in a two-minute video, which makes me wonder what the hell I'm doing.
Well,
but it showed the disconnect between the way marketers think and the way consumers think, and why marketers trying to dictate their messages to consumers simply don't understand that the tide has turned.
So you've written two books. The two books are, And Now a Few Words from Me, Advertising Critic Lays Down the Law Once and For All. You wrote that a couple years ago. And before that, in the late 90s, you wrote Waking Up Screaming, NPR's Roving Correspondent Reports from the Bumpy Road to Success. So you've written two books. But what I noticed that you're doing recently with The Chaos Theory and Listenomics is that you're almost making essays, or you're serializing content in Ad Age. You have this chapter by chapter thing you're doing on Listenomics in your blog. Why have you moved from publishing books to doing more of this kind of give it away free online stuff?
Well, I'm trying to practice what I preach. My theory is that the future is all about creating connections between corporations, governments, political parties, interest groups, and so forth, and individuals. And in writing the book on that subject, I'm trying to do the very same thing, actually engage the very audience that I'm writing about. In theory, at least, we will have a conversation, and the conversation, I mean, it's not a wiki. I'm not asking anyone to write the book for me, but I am interested in feedback during the process of writing the book, in case I've missed something, or in case I've gotten something wrong, in case I'm on the wrong track. And I want to hear from the principals and from interested observers just to see, you know, how I can make the book better with their help. And it's not working that well. Right now, I'm just writing stuff and getting very, very little response.
You know why, though? I'll tell you why. Here's a piece of advice for you. You know, I researched you quite a bit, spent you know, quite a few hours just kind of digging up all the things you've done and really assessing who you are as a person. You have a lot of richness to you that is not getting conveyed because your stuff is scattered. You do your philanthropic media watchdog stuff at On the Media, and you're on that foundation, Media Watchdog Foundation. You are the marketing district attorney. You do that in your blog. You do your essays in Ad Age in print. You got to dig them up on the site, but you can't really get to them unless you're a subscriber, which I am, but not everyone is. Like, there needs to be a Bob spot where all the richness of everything you are, from your political advertising to the ad critic work, where there's just kind of this collective, and at the front of that is your latest theories on, I wouldn't call you a futurist, I would call you a what the heck is actually happening nowist. You seem to be really good at that. And it's too disjointed to pull together for anyone to... I might be the only one who could actually sit down and give you some feedback, because I did like 3 hours work gathering the stuff together. So my advice is to put more stuff in one place so we can follow your threads and get that richness and give you some feedback.
Well, I think that's good advice. And I'm pretty much all over it. I'm actually in the process, because I want to generate speaking engagements, because that's how I make a big part of my income.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to create a sort of central Bobo page.
Yep.
My only fear is that draws people away from Advertising Age, which is my principal employer,
yeah.
And I don't want to do anything which takes any of my audience away from the people who put food on my table. So I have to respect my employer. At the same time, it's true, I am scattered. You know, there's several Bob Garfields, and there's some overlap in the various things I do, but it does create a kind of schizophrenic problem. And, you know, I describe myself as a multi-mediocrity, and, you know, I'm only half kidding when I say that.
I love that. Well, you're definitely not how do you say that?
Yeah, I don't know. It's somewhere between mediocre and media. So, you know.
Mediocre. Got me all screwed up. All right.
Choose.
We only have a couple minutes left, and I want to get to some of the more Bobby stuff. So do you like the little yellow and do you like the little striped tabby cat, Garfield?
No. He's destroyed my life.
Has he?
Yeah. I've had many conversations with his creator, Jim Davis, who at the moment has a restraining order against me. But, you know, the cat has ruined my life. And we'll just leave it at that.
Well, it's funny, too, because you kind of look like him.
Thanks. You're very, very sweet. Well, thank you. You're very kind, Susan.
You're leaving me now. No, because your hair is kind of has a little bit of a reddish cast.
Yeah, it sure does.
To it. And you've got the little bit of gray creeping in, which I know I'm not supposed to notice that either, right? But that's kind of like a little stripey. So I was thinking that over time. And you know, you put on a few pounds.
But here's the thing, Susan. At this stage of my career, I was hoping to sell, you know, coffee mugs with my picture on them.
Yeah.
Instead, the market is completely cornered by, you know, a freaking fictional cartoon character who, when I was a featured newspaper columnist, you know, had me exponentially outnumbered in the number of newspapers he appeared in. I was in 20, he was in 2000, and he doesn't even exist.
I'm sorry. all I can say. All right, so here's something that's a little bit weird, which I like. Your favorite movie is a George Segal movie called King Rat, and it's about these prisoners of war who start trading in rat as meat, right?
Well, that's, you know, that's one of the plot points. By the way, it's not my favorite movie.
Oh.
It's my favorite movie of movies that are nobody else's favorite movie.
Well, there's a qualifier.
I think Doctor Strangelove is probably my favorite movie, or maybe The Godfather Part Two. But King Rat is definitely my, you know, personal treasure. And it's about a Japanese prisoner of war camp in Singapore. And George Segal plays a kind of a black marketeer who has a perfectly pristine uniform and everybody else is in rags. And it's about the life in this camp. It was a James Clavell novel, which itself was a masterpiece. And the film is simply magnificent.
So we can get that on Netflix. I checked it out.
Good.
I just watched Iwo Jima last night, and that was quite good. But Ken Watanabe's so hot that, you know, it was in Japanese and I still loved it. Now, you also recently read a novel called Everyman by Philip Roth. What a prolific and amazing gift to America that man is. But I haven't read the book, so I was trying to do a little studying about Everyman and why you said it's such a masterpiece, you're contemplating suicide. What I noticed was that it was the only thing that caught my eye about the book was that apparently as you age, you get this erotic resurgence opportunity. And I thought, okay, so I'm 46 next week, and maybe I have something to look forward to.
This is really frightening because your husband is engineering this program.
Actually, we have a fabulous sex life. And if you know anything about personal life media, it's all very sexy. And so I have nothing to worry about.
Okay, yeah, then you can read the book with impunity.
I can. I'm actually in the best sex life of my life right now, and certainly loving telling people about that. But tell me why you're now contemplating suicide. We can't lose you.
Because of what I face. You know, this is a novella more than a full-fledged novel, but it's just a sketch, but it's an astonishing sketch because, you know, literature is all about finding human truth, and this book just bathes in it. It's about a man who, by the way, was an advertising creative, and he had a very vivid life. He made a lot of errors in judgment. He basically screwed up his life, mainly by entanglements with women, most of whom he married, And he kind of spiraled downward like the media marketing infrastructure we were discussing earlier. And now he is, you know, he is retired and lonely and bored, and yet he continues to think about his erotic life and the mistakes he made, but mostly he thinks about the deterioration of his physical being and of what faces him. And it's not just the death of his body, but the death of his erotic life, which substantially has been his life. And it's it's heartbreaking, it's frightening, it's just a little bit of perfection. And why am I suicidal? Because I'm not really looking forward to going through that stage of regret and loss. Who wants that?
Well, it is the human condition, and you shall do it.
Great, thanks.
So we're gonna end our interview. I've had a lot of fun with you, Bob. Thank you. I was a little intimidated to interview you. You're very, very smart and articulate and doing really great work in so many categories. And certainly someone who is a real draw for our industry. So thank you for giving me the time to let everybody get to know you better. When I do my interviews, I email you and I ask you to tell me a few little things about yourself. You said, you know, what your favorite film was that no one liked and the book that you read that made an impact on you recently. And you also said that the product 2,000 flushes, that you can get about 2,600 flushes with that.
Yeah.
Why the hell did you write that? Are you just...
Well, because I don't have many superpowers, and that's one of them.
You're such a goof. You do have many superpowers. I would disagree. I would disagree. You are the marketing district attorney, and you fight for the rights of good media. And for that, we thank you. Every single person listening today, I'm sure, has been appreciative of anything they've read from you. So keep it coming and get it all organized. Good luck with that. I've got some ideas about how you can still support Ad Age and do that too, so we can talk offline. And thanks for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you, Susan. It's really been a pleasure.
Good. I'm glad. All right. Well, thanks so much, listeners, for tuning in today. I really appreciate it. I hope I did a good job for you bringing you the fabulous Bob Garfield, and I hope I'll get you back listening with us again next week. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.